the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, well, has nothing better to do on a Sunday afternoon. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahanty for a special mailbag episode. G'day, Doc. How are you?
I am very good, Captain. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to see you here on a Sunday.
Virtual Sunday.
Virtual. Yeah, well, it's Friday morning. But it's Sunday somewhere.
You know, I'm looking forward to you flying me in a rocket here on on Sunday to record the podcast.
You don't want to get any rocket I your build mate will give you just quietly.
Okay, fine.
I wouldn't do that if I were you. We are going to get stuck into a special mailbag. We got so much mailbag, Matt. We're going to get through as much as we possibly can. On Friday, I neglected to mention our socials. And our socials, the cool kids say socials. It's short for social media. I'm cool like that. I'm on Instagram, mate. I'm with it. I'm with the kids.
You're with the happening times.
Are you on TikTok yet?
Well, my daughter is on TikTok.
Is she on TikTok? How's that going?
I don't know. I really find that whole platform a little bit on the, I don't know where it stands.
Yeah. So funny. So we both have young children, or getting older now, but children anyway. So a couple of funny stories during the massive tangent to start the episode. A couple of funny stories during the week. Have you, your daughter ever watched Teen Titans Go?
I don't know, but I'll have to ask.
I avoid it. It's kind of like it's kind of funny, and they do a good job of making kids jokes and adult jokes so that parents will actually bother watching. They did a whole funny spoof episode on the sharing economy, which is just very, very funny, talking about the fact that everything was being, they were renting out rooms and body parts, and it was just very, very funny, and a kind of nice sort of satire social take. Have you heard of Dude Perfect, speaking of other things?
No.
So YouTube, Dude Perfect, as you'd imagine it's spelt. These guys have more YouTube subscribers than the NBA. They made their name doing trick shots with basketballs and golf balls and all sorts of really, it's actually really quite cool. My son is obsessed with the thing, and it is just, in terms of socials, this thing is just off the charts cool, but also just has, apparently these guys are worth like tens of millions of dollars just from doing trick shots on YouTube videos.
That sounds fascinating.
We're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
None of that's got anything to do with our mailbag, but it does have a lot to do with socials, which is what dragged me down that sordid and horrible path. If you want to get in touch with us, where will I start, mate? I'll start with Instagram. Are you on Instagram yet?
No.
I'm going to keep asking you. You can hit us up on Instagram. I'm at TMF, as in The Motley Fool, at TMF Scott P, or The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. You can leave a comment, see some of our posts, send us a direct message if you want. Questions, comments, or feedback, always welcome. You can also, I'm gonna leave the best to last, mate. You can also jump on Facebook. I'm Scott Phillips Money, all one word. And The Motley Fool is The Motley Fool Australia. Surprise, surprise. I know. How do we come up with that, Doc? Just creativity.
Oh, we're very creative.
We are creative geniuses.
Yeah, we are awesome.
So if you're on Facebook, again, comment on our post, leave us a message, send us a direct mail. Or Twitter, which Doc is on. So if you want to talk to Doc, at Anirban Mahanty, or one word, at Anirban Mahanty. I'm at TMF Scott P, and The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. Again, super surprising. Hit us up on one of those, have a chat, leave us a comment, ask us a question. We love getting them. We love answering them. And also, if you like the old school, as I regularly say, info@fool.com.au is a great way to send us an email. That'll go to our member services fools. They will flick it our way and make sure we get it and we can answer it on the show. So please get in touch. As we always say, we love hearing your questions and comments. Frankly, we're doing an episode here on Sunday afternoon, stuck in the studio, virtual Sunday anyway, because we love doing it. Mate, first question for this time is a question for Phil, from Phil, sorry. Phil says, hi, Scott and Doc. Thanks for answering my previous question. It definitely put my mind at ease. Lots of good news. I am interested in both of your thoughts on recycling companies and the future prospects of them in Australia and the world. The reason I ask is because I saw an interview with Twiggy Forrest, and he was very passionate about the topic and had a lot of good ideas. A successful businessman like Twiggy, should we be following his lead? Thanks, Phil. Doc, what do you say? Recycling companies, yay or nay?
You know, I like the idea, like, of recycling companies and how it can be beneficial to
work. We're actually recycling the company, right? We mean companies doing recycling.
Yeah. Recycling companies that recycle stuff.
Just being clear.
Yeah, so I like that idea. I know that one of the co-founders of Tesla and its former CTO, forgot his name now, Strobel, I think Strobel. He has a recycling company, recycling stuff. I think recycling batteries or lithium ion batteries and stuff like that. So this is, but I haven't yet found one company that I think is interesting or worthy of investing. So this is an area that I think is interesting, but I don't know of many companies that are, that are worthy investments, in my opinion, at least at this point. So, I mean, you know, interesting, but I don't know, would probably be the correct answer.
Yep, I'm going to share that thought, mate. Very quick. I'm going to try to get through a heap of Marmite, so I'll keep it quick this time. I agree completely. Sims Metal is one of Australia that's had a terrible track record of trying to recycle iron. It fluctuates wildly with the commodity price, so you think it's a recycling business. Effectively, investors and the market treats it as a substitute for the original raw material. Similarly, paper recycling, I listened to a Planet Money podcast episode a few months ago where the recycling company is actually paying people to take some of the paper off them because they've got so much of it. So I don't know these are great investment ideas. I wish they were. Like many people, it'd be good for the environment if we had more recycling. I completely agree with that. The economics of the business, though, aren't necessarily the same as what we wish they would be. I would stay well and truly clear until you know for a fact, or at least for reasonable certainty, that these things are going to be profitable. Mate, next question is from Howie. Ready? Listen to the sound effect. That didn't really work, really. It was supposed to be a bell kind of sound. I hit my keys against
how about this one?
Soft drink bottle. No, we'll work on that.
For those who don't know, I've got actually two Allen keys, big Allen keys, and I want to use that to make, you know.
Oh, we are bringing the high production values. You don't get that sort of stuff from any other podcast, I guarantee it.
How many podcasts have Allen keys?
I've got
one, two,
or
three,
Coke bottles
four,
and keys.
I've got like five of various sizes here.
For the record, Doc didn't bring them, and they were actually already in the studio. Yeah. Mate, that is very funny. I love that. All right. Howie, let's move on. Howie says, hi, Scott and Doc. Thanks for answering my previous question on the podcast. I have another one, if it's worthy of a discussion. To quote your number one investor, Mr. Buffett, he has said he'll leave 90% of his money when he dies in a simple, low-cost S&P 500 index fund. Absolutely true. So my question is, what are your and Doc's thoughts on this? And is there advantage of an index fund over an ETF that would also track the index? Also on the same line, what is the advantage of purchasing an index such as the Spider S&P ASX 200 over, say, a Vanguard ETF when both obviously have the same companies within? Thanks, mate. Howie. Doc, index fund versus ETF.
So, I'm reading this as, I mean, you know, there is a fund version of it, which is like basically investing with the fund manager. Right. And then there is a tradable version of that, which is basically the ETF with the unit trust, I guess, units.
So let's break down some jargon, mate. Yeah. ETF stands for?
Exchange Traded Fund.
Which does exactly what it says on the tin, right?
Yeah, which is basically the fund that trades, the fund version, the version that trades on the stock market and therefore has plenty of liquidity,
yep,
and so on and so forth, right? So I would interpret Buffett's comment as meaning that would be happy to put it in an ETF, for example.
I think that's exactly right. So the ETF is just an exchange-traded version of exactly the same thing. I don't know of any good reason to invest in the fund rather than the ETF, with the exception that the fund often, and Buffett doesn't have this problem, often allows for regular incremental deposits with no brokerage. So if you're going to contribute $100 a month or something and you can do that without brokerage, there may be some benefits in using the fund, the managed fund version, the non-exchange traded version. If you have sufficient capital that you're investing each time, I just don't see any reason you wouldn't use the ETF.
Yeah, so just to clarify, the most brokers in the US now don't charge a brokerage fee.
That's true, right.
So that even doesn't matter.
Right.
I think most of these funds have actually like near zero fees, or the ETFs have near zero fees. So, I mean, it's as cheap as it gets to invest.
There still is. So for someone looking at an ASX-listed ETF, which Sky is, there is still some brokerage.
There's still some fees.
Yeah.
I think the only bigger difference might be that I think with the fund, you can actually set up a schedule to invest, you know, put 500 every month or put 1,000 every month and invest. Whereas here, you actually physically have to do the act of putting, you know, the money in and then buying, right?
And there's a real benefit in that.
Yeah. So I think, that, you know, in index, there's not much of a difference, I think. And then the other part of the question is, what's the difference between...
I think you might have already given this one away, but what's the difference between a Spider, which is run by BlackRock?
Yeah, BlackRock.
SPDR, you'll see. So they pronounce it Spider. the BlackRock S&P ASX 200 or the Vanguard ETF, which is code VAS. What's the difference?
We're both so there's the same a slight company. Difference here. The one slight difference is, well, there are a couple of reasons. One, they're different providers. So mm-hmm. one is a BlackRock fund, the other is a Vanguard fund, yes. both available as an ETF.
Yep.
They have slightly different structures in terms of fees. Vanguard is basically as low as possible. BlackRock is also reducing as much as possible. But I think, you know, probably the Vanguard will win in terms of fee structure. Mm-hmm. There's another difference, I think. As far as I know, if I remember this correctly off the top of my head, the Vanguard ETF is actually ASX 300.
Correct.
So it takes the top 300 companies by liquidity and market capitalization and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. Whereas the other one is ASX 200. So I think you get a little bit more diversification with the 300 because you get, you know, some of the smaller companies and some of the higher growth companies that show up in the 300. My own preference would be to take the 300 over the 200, largely because I think you get a little bit more, you know, that's a little bit because the, you know, the overall concentration mm-hmm. is still the same, but I would think that the VAS would do slightly better.
Makes sense. I think it's a really good point, mate. I can't argue with any of that. I think the fund provider choice is largely... I don't know, mate. I think I would probably prefer to choose the lower fee over the broader index if I was given the choice. Over the fullness of time, I was going to invest for 20 or 30 years. Would you go for the broader diversification or the lower fee given the choice?
Well, in this case, the lower fee is the broader index.
True. But in terms of making your choice, which would you prefer?
It really depends on, I guess it depends on what is the difference in terms of returns one would expect versus what is the fees, right? I mean, if the fees are significant, I would take the lower fees, right? Yeah. But if the fees are really tiny, then probably I look for this, you know, if I can get an out edge with the better return. But yeah, I mean, paying lower fees matters, I think.
Very good. Let's move on. Question from Turnerator, also on Instagram. I'll save the sound effects this time. Maybe, no, 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 oh, don't.
No, no, sound
leave the Allen keys.
Oh, I was going to get the Allen keys. I mean, you know.
All right. He says, hi, Scott and Doc. Stake recently changed their business model. Stake being the US broker out of Australia doing fee-free or brokerage-free transactions, making their money on the foreign exchange. Stake recently changed their business model to now being a subscription service. Originally, the service offered free of charge unlimited trades as well as fractional shares. Now, fractional share is for $100, you can buy 1/10 of a share of a $1,000 company, for example, it's a fractional share. They took a percentage of the foreign exchange as well as the market spread to make money. However, their greed has taken over. This is Turnerator's words, not mine. You now have to pay $9 a month to trade fractional shares and to have unlimited trades. A farce indeed. The entire draw of Stake for me is to be able to access the American market fractionally and also with free brokerage. Apparently now this business model doesn't seem to be working, so they are pivoting to charging their users. Do you think with the advent of commission-free trading in the States, it's a matter of time before a big bank here steps up and claims the vacuum that Stake has left? Love to hear your thoughts. Full on. Doc, you are the US trading guru here. I have a few US shares, but don't trade anywhere near as frequently as you do. Your thoughts on what's changing with Stake and some other options?
Well, that's interesting, actually. I was not aware of this change, so that's interesting to know. Clearly, I mean... without knowing the details, if I had to guess, I would say this is a sustainability type of thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you charge monthly, it's a regularized stream. Everybody loves a subscription business model. Mm. Investors love a subscription business model, and business owners love a subscription business model because of the regularity mm-hmm. of the money coming in.
Yep.
But I mean, you know, I can see how this can be a problem if you are trading smaller amounts and therefore you're actually paying up a lot in fees, which is eating into your returns effectively, right? So mm-hmm. that's I think a problematic thing.
Yeah.
Look, if anybody's trading, I shouldn't use the word trading. If anybody wants to over time have a substantial amount of money invested in US stocks, then it makes sense to actually have a proper US broker, like, you know, Charles Schwab or TD Ameritrade or Interactive Brokers or something like that. Mm-hmm. With those, you actually get the zero commission trades, right? Now, some of these guys might have actually pretty high minimum nowadays, especially with Charles Schwab having retreated out of Australia.
That's crazy. It's like a 10 grand minimum to fund the account or something, isn't it?
Somebody told me it's actually 25 grand. So it used to be $3,000.
Yeah.
So this is almost like basically saying we don't want additional accounts. Thank you very much.
That sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just sounds like that. So, I mean, what really surprises me is has been said, why hasn't a big bank tried or some other person tried to do, come into the space and think, and maybe it's the market is just not big enough to cause that kind of disruption.
I dare say that's it, mate.
So yeah, those are my thoughts. Mm.
Look, I will add to that a little bit. I looked up the pricing on Stake. So to be clear, and I should say, by the way, we have a kind of a quasi relationship with Stake, just to be really, really transparent. We have no interest in them. They have no interest in us. I don't believe money's ever changed hands. We did use them as a service alternative for people who are looking to trade US stocks when we launched a US service mid last year. We used their video. They've used our video. We're saying they're good guys. I think that's also true. So just to completely disclose that up front to contextualize anything I say next. Looking at their website, they still have a $0 a month product, which is 2 free trades a month, and then $5 a trade thereafter. For many people, that still might be enough, by the way. So that's the first thing. Second thing is their $9 a month is unlimited. It's free until July 2020. So again, a few months worth of that. But of course, after that, you're kind of stuck. That is unlimited free trades. So 2 trades a month for nothing or $9 a month for unlimited free trades and fractional shares and a whole lot more on top of that. So that's just for clarity and just for kind of filling in some detail there. The problem we have in Australia is, frankly, as Doc's already mentioned, the market's way too small for anyone to bother or care about, right? So Charles Schwab, one of the biggest brokers in the US, don't want our money badly enough to, take small investors. They want it only if we're large enough to, frankly, generate some value. And while I am the first person to say don't pay fees, you don't need to, I'm also not exactly surprised that Charles Schwab is saying, well, you guys in Australia, you're gonna put a couple of grand in. I've got to have a customer service team and deal with a whole lot of that. I don't really want the small accounts, and the market's too small to believe that it's worth staffing 24/7 for little accounts, all that kind of stuff. Now, would I like them to? Yes. Do I blame them for not doing it? Well, not if it's not profitable for them. So I'm kind of caught between a rock and a hard place here. If you have the money to fund an account, I think that makes some sense. If you don't, Stake is probably still around the cheapest option, I think, Doc. If you're going to make a couple of trades with a couple of grand, I think $9 a month sucks from a personal perspective. By the same token, if you trade twice a month for a year, that's 24 trades for $100. Call it $5 a trade among friends. If you're with ComSec, you're going to pay, what's it now with ComSec, $50 or something like that?
That's pretty high. Yeah.
NAB trade's probably the same. ANZZ trade's probably the same. Again, Schwab is much cheaper, but you've got to have the money to fund the account. So, it's a really, really difficult one if you're just building up a US trading account. I think you should invest in the US. For some people, maybe it's worth using Stake. Maybe it's worth using one of the big guys. If you're going to make one US transaction every 3 months with ComSec, you do it for a few years, so you got more than $25,000, then move your money across. You can move the shares directly, not just the funds you'd have to sell to move them across. So there's different ways of doing it. I think that's probably how I'd do it. Doc, if you were starting now with a couple of grand in the back pocket and you want to invest in the US, how would you do it?
Yeah, I think that's probably reasonable. I mean, I have an account with another company called Saxo.
Oh, that's right, you do.
Saxo Capital Markets. Now, one of the things, I mean, they have very low fees for across the markets, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
One of the things, though, that to keep in mind is they actually charge an account keeping fee, which
they all get you.
They are somehow, which is a percentage of, although small, I think it's like 0.12%. But think of 0.12% of any decent amount is actually quite a bit of money going out, right? So it's effectively another quasi fee. Whether you call it trading fee. So that's an option. I like your strategy. Start an account with someone. You can then transfer those shares over.
Yeah.
It still costs some money, I think, sometimes to transfer the shares because there's paperwork involved. It messes up your transaction information and things like that. But I think that's what I would do.
Yeah. I think I probably agree. There are other brokers that do let you trade in the US, I said ComSec do it, NAB trade do it, Westpac do it. Interactive Brokers, we've talked about, is really cheap, but incredibly not user-friendly at all. I wouldn't actually recommend them unless you would desperately want to do it. Plenty of others. So just be mindful and do it. I think I'd probably pay up. I think I'd probably save a bit more, pay up a bit more in brokerage. If you pay $50 a trade for a $2,000 purchase, that's 2.5%. It's pretty ugly, but it's not terrible. And if you're going to build as we talked about Friday, the habits of investing well, if you make some long-term investments for that sort of money, eventually you'll have more than $25,000. You can start then make some different choices. Will it cost you more in brokerage than you should have to pay? Yes, absolutely. In the absence of any alternatives, that still might be the best option, I think. I think. Again, steak for $100 a year is probably also, again, is it ugly? Does it hurt? Yes. Is it a terrible option? Probably not. Let's not get started.
Mm-hmm.
All right, mate. Next question is from Jeremy. But first,
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Jeremy says, hello, gents. Investing in the share market or in property, to me, seems like holding an asset without contributing to society or the economy. I like this question. For example, Scott often says avoiding buying unethical company shares has little positive ethical effect. And I won't go over the reasons why. Listen to our previous couple of podcasts if you want some thoughts on that one. But it's undoubtedly true. Your money makes no difference at all when you invest in so-called ethical companies. My question is then, what are some accessible ways to invest that would have an impact? And are they more risky or lower profit? I imagine providing capital for a startup would be one way to do this, but it would be less accessible as the share market. Still loving the show. Full on. He says, please, P.S., please use my first name only for the pod. Please and thanks. Well, luckily I did, Jeremy. Oh, could have been ugly, couldn't I? Could have at this point, we'd have started again.
I think so, yeah. So,
our listeners will be surprised, mate, to know this is not an edited podcast.
Well, this is definitely not edited.
I mean, it comes across so well, I imagine they think there's lots of production
values. I'm not so sure about what I said, but yeah.
Well, then there's the other key, so maybe they don't. We do this in one take, believe it or not, with the exception of last week where we did it three times because the machine broke.
Yeah.
But, Jeremy, so luckily I didn't use your surname. We don't have to do this all again. Doc, if you want to make a positive impact with your investment dollars, what can you do?
Well, you know, this is a hard question. I mean, the stock market is effectively a secondary market. Like, I mean, okay, I'm going to caveat that to some extent. Like, I mean, some companies still invest, you know, are on the stock market and they raise capital on the stock market.
Right.
So, I mean, you can, to some extent, influence that by buying stocks of those companies. Effectively, you can provide direct capital to companies. Like, you know, like a share placement plan, for example, is an example. I think it has a minimal impact in that overall, because I think most of the seeding is already done at the venture stage. The other thing is that, you know, you want to provide, you know, employment and all these options, and you want to create these new companies, but VCs probably don't want to take our money at that stage, right? And those companies that don't get VC money, you probably don't want to invest in them. They probably are poorer quality investments overall. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of VC money floating around. So VC being venture capital. So I don't know really. I mean, start a small business is contributory to the economy and, you know, your local society and so on. But not everyone, again, is going to start a small business. And, you know, I can understand that. It's a hard one. Unless somebody's an entrepreneur and they are starting a business and creating jobs and so on. I mean, you know, what I like to say is that, you know, I want the best entrepreneurs to do the job of that instead of everybody trying to do it, because that, you know, everybody trying is actually not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. Look, I love this question, Jeremy, because it's exactly the right next question in the sequence, right? If we start by saying investing in so-called ethical companies makes no difference, and it doesn't, with the very, very small exception that Doc says of companies raising money in secondary offerings, capital raisings, as we like to call them, to some degree, those companies need funding, and you can have a very, very minor impact at the margins on the cost of that funding, whether you engage or don't engage in it. If they have to desperately try harder to find more people, then, you know, that kind of makes a small difference, very, very small difference. Here's the thing. Impact investing is really hard. So impact investing is what they call the investing you're doing for a particular purpose. Here's my thinking with that. If an idea is good enough, it doesn't need so-called impact investing, right? Venture capitalists are greedy enough and good enough at their jobs. If something's going to make money, they will fund it, I guarantee you. Whether it's a coal mine or a wind farm, they will throw money at it if it's going to make money. If it's not going to make money or not going to make enough money to justify their investment, then you're kind of in the space of you're choosing to make lower returns than you otherwise could make. You're deliberately sacrificing returns to have that impact you're trying to make over and above what someone else would do. In other words, the stuff that's already going to make money doesn't need funding because the capitalists are going to chase that stuff. What you're really talking about is adding your value, adding your wealth, adding your input to the next level of ideas that otherwise wouldn't be funded at all. And again, as I said, the problem is they're not going to be funded because they're not going to make any money or may not make any money. So you're in a very risky or lower return space by doing that. I got to say, for most people, I don't think it's where you want to be. And not because I don't care about the environment. I desperately care about the environment. But I don't know that if it's that questionable an investment, you run the risk of A, either losing everything or B, making a really crappy return. Again, are you better off taking some of your profits and redeploying that to a charity or to something else? I dare say you probably are. And so this is a really unsatisfactory answer. But for the most part, lock in the gains however you make them and then use that wealth for good. The What If founder, Graham Wood, who founded whatif.com, he then sold it. He spent a whole lot of money on things like starting, I think he funded The Guardian for a little while in Australia. He, and again, whether you like it or not, you know, he used that for philanthropic reasons. He's funding a whole lot of development in Tasmania, of all places. You know, there are great ways of using it. Now, we're not all Graham Wood. We're not going to make hundreds of millions of dollars, but he's used the money he made from a ethically run, for what it's worth, but a for-profit business, to go and fund some good, positive change elsewhere. I still think that's probably the best way to do it. Now, there are some options. There are things like green bonds, where companies or organizations, buy things like land to plant more trees. That's definitely a net positive. And if you add money to that, they can probably buy more land. Now, the returns are probably pretty small. You may feel good about that and better about that. And that is definitely something where extra money does go to extra assets. So that's what you're looking for. If you're looking for impact investing in that sense, what is it that you're adding money to that goes to producing more of something rather than simply changing the price of it? If I'm raising $100, I can offer whatever return I want to offer. Now, the more people throw money at me, the lower return I get to offer. So if Doc wants to throw me $100, I'll say, well, I'll give you 5%. If the guy next door says, well, I want to throw you $100 too, I'll say, well, what about 4%? If he takes it, then great. He gets a lower return, I get the money. If no one wants to give me the $100, then I start saying, well, I'll give you 10%, 15%, 20%. Someone give me the money. So that's, but the amount of money I'm raising is going to be the same regardless. In this case, if you can contribute to an asset being purchased, like land for trees, for example, or carbon credits or something else, that's a really, really positive way to do it. There's a whole lot of charities out there, as I said. Let's not get into the kind of charity thing. For what it's worth, our family has a yearly subscription to a thing called Green Fleet, which offsets the carbon emissions of our cars. Is that investing? No, but they're planting trees to offset that carbon emission. I feel pretty good about that. So there's ways of contributing to a charity or to an organization that is going out and doing extra things. And the more money they get, the more they can do. So whether it's a charity or some version of a green bond or something, that's one kind of possible option you've got. Impact investing is possible, but it's high risk and generally speaking, lower return. I'm not convinced that that's a place you want to play as an individual investor. Doc, any thoughts on that one?
I think you've covered it all.
Very good. The good thing is, by the way, we've got a... I'll hold that one, actually. We've got another bit of good feedback for us, mate, but I'll hold that. Next question comes from Nico. Nico says, hi, Scott and Doc. I'm currently trying to buy some international stock, but it's not covered by my international NAB or ComSec accounts. For comparison's sake, and not after specific advice, one example is it's a gold company listed on the London Exchange. I would like to buy about $2,000 worth. How much should a trade like this cost? I'm happy to pay a little bit more in fees up front as I'm a long-term investor, but I want to avoid any ongoing fees that eat up my returns. I'd also like an account that gives me access to Hong Kong and Canadian exchanges. Do you have any recommendations for an easy-to-use from Australia international broker with minimum fees? Also, are there any potential pitfalls I should be aware of? This is kind of like the question we just had, but a little bit different. If you want to trade in London, Canada, and Hong Kong and avoid fees, what do you do?
Well, you can't avoid fees. Fees are almost unavoidable. Yep. But yeah, as I said, so the one of the reasons I set up the Saxo Capital Market account was that, you know, I have some interest in Asian companies, mm-hmm. And just, you know, some interest in you know, European companies, and this is one platform that gives you access to essentially almost all of the developed market. That was the reason. So, I mean, you can use a platform like that. That'll give you access to most of these markets. It's, you know, it's not free because, you know, there's that account keeping fee that you're paying, and then you're paying a small amount of the brokerage fees, quite manageable. So that's that. I think that's one way to do it. What else in terms of, you know, how much the fee, you know, again, like, you know, say it'll, you don't want to pay more than 1-2% of the amount you're buying in fees. Otherwise, you're really giving up a lot in fees.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sort of my rough rule of thumb.
Yep. I like this question. I like your answer, Doc. I think if you're a frequent trader or a frequent investor, well, I don't mean trader, I don't mean trading back and forth. I just mean you're trading infrequently. I would say go for a higher fee with no ongoing fee, because you don't know, as you've already said, pay monthly fees month after month after month after month for a trade you made 5 years ago. So, you know, prefer the higher fee over lower fees if you have the choice. Most brokers, I do have inactivity fees and stuff like that. So just be really, really careful. I think your directed broker is probably best for all those exchanges.
I think, yeah, you can, yeah, but yeah. I just find it harder to say go to Interactive Broker Lodge, yep, because, you know, it's just, I think, yep, there's a lot of getting used to involved with Interactive Broker. It is definitely, yeah, one of the lowest fee platforms out there.
Yeah. Nico, my other question, mate, would be, I'd probably just say for everyone, this is not personal advice, for everybody, if you're making smaller transactions in international companies, I would probably ask a couple of questions. One would be, and this is a rhetorical question for you to think about for yourself, do you really want to spread your analytical efforts that thinly that you're looking for companies in all these different exchanges? I wonder where you're getting the information or the advice or the ideas from, how much time you're spending doing it. If they're genuinely great ideas and you've got that much time and effort to scour that many great ideas across that much of the world, then awesome. I don't. I do this for a job. I haven't looked at the Hong Kong or London exchanges, I think, ever, Doc. I don't know if you have. There's just too much else out there to go with. So I kind of think, you know, again, if you want to do it, by all means, do it. Like, I'm not telling you not to. I'm just curious as to whether you think you genuinely have an advantage in those markets and those companies. And for smaller, large amounts of money, $2,000 is a lot of money, but, you know, over an investing career, is that money not better off investing in Australia or in the US? And again, as Doc said before, investing in the US, on the US market, you can obviously or often access many, many international companies. So the bigger UK, European, Asian companies often have listed American depository receipts, they call them, that give you access to those companies. So that's probably what I think of. I think I probably err on the side of maybe just giving it a miss, quite honestly. Unless it's such a great deal, you definitely want to be involved for the long term, I'd probably redirect the $2,000 to an Australian or US investment, I think, Doc.
Yeah, I think I agree.
Good news is from Nico. Also, in regards to a previous message, I ended up getting 3.23% with my current MyState loan with no transfer fees. Pays to ask. Thanks for your encouragement over the last year. How good is that? 3.2, if you're not already, hashtag get a better rate. Call your bank, get a better rate. I promise you they don't need the money, as I say every single time, more than you do. You deserve the lower rate. Call your bank. I'll tell them that MyState's giving 3.2%. See if you can beat it. And if you do, let us know on the socials. Let us know what you're getting so we can encourage other people to save some money as well. More encouragingly, at least for me, Doc, Nico says, I would still be waiting for a crash and would have missed out on my current 19% return. By being invested, Nico was worried about the market crashing, and so being uninvested, not being invested over the last year, 2019, the market was about 25%, Nico. So that would have been a lot to lose by not being invested last year. Always be invested is our rule. Ride the waves. Next question, Doc.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
This one comes from Gabriel. He says, hi, Scott and Doc. Hope you find some time for this question on your amazing podcast. See, Gabriel, you know how to get a question answered. I've been a bit lax on the other questions so far.
Yeah, I know.
We haven't got any egregious praise.
Yeah, I know. The praise is very important. We love the praise.
Oh, dear, dear. Lift your game, people. We're not a charity. Well, we're doing this for free, I suppose. We are a charity to some degree. Anyway, we have feelings. We have, you know, we have families and feelings, and but just be nice. Give us some praise. Come on. Is it that hard?
The praise is the fee.
There you go. Gabriel has paid his fee, so he's getting his question answered.
Yep.
Hi, Scott and Doc. Hope you find some time for this question on your amazing podcast. I've been looking at Soul Patts recently, as I've heard you refer to them as the Australian Berkshire Hathaway. But I've noticed they have underperformed the ASX 200 over the last 12 months. As they have overperformed over any other longer time period, would you see this as an opportunity to buy in? And what do you think about this company at the moment? Buy, hold, or sell? Looking forward to hearing your thoughts. Thanks, Gabe. In brackets, long-time listener. Good man, thank you. We appreciate your support. Do you want me to take this one, mate?
Hey, you take it.
You're not a Soul Patts fan. So firstly, it's a recommendation of ours. Secondly, I own shares. So again, use the appropriate amount of salt. Look, Gabriel, here's the time frames are really funny. Doc and I have had this conversation. I haven't got a really great way of describing this on air or in writing yet, but I need to do it at some point. When we look at returns on stocks, we pick two arbitrary points, right? We say this time 5 years ago, 1 year ago, 6 months ago, 10 years ago, and we say, right, from that arbitrary point to now, here's what the shares have done. And they might be up 20%, down 20%. That point 10 years ago may be really, really, really relevant, or actually might be completely irrelevant. For example, during the GFC, yeah, in 2017, you look back 10 years, things look really, you know, if your shares were flat against 2007 numbers, well, you haven't done very well. If you wait 2 years, the share price hasn't changed, but the 10-year-ago number goes a whole lot lower because the market crashed, as you might recall, in 2009. And so even if the share price of the asset you own hasn't changed, all of a sudden your gain looks massive because you've held it for another 2 years and the 10-year-ago number is lower. So it's not always necessarily about the price now. It can just simply be about which metric you choose to compare against. Now, you're not wrong to ask the question, Gabriel, and you're dead right. I'm just making the point that if you think about comparisons, they are by definition arbitrary. And the question is, was the 12-month-ago number the right number to compare against, as much as is the current share price attractive. So generally speaking, I don't love using any charting. I don't normally look at past prices. As I said before, if the price is down 10%, some people say, oh, it's so much cheaper, let's buy. Other people say, oh, it's falling, why would you buy? And the reverse, when the share price are up, people say, oh, it's already up, I'm not buying. Other people say, oh, great, it's on the way up, let's buy now before it goes higher. That's so much psychology and a lot of investment theory behind that, unfortunately, but that's the way humans are. All of that said, Soul Patts has done very well. And I think if you think about the long term, absolutely the share price is important. The good news is for Soul Patts, was up over 1, 3, 5, 10, and 15 years. So over multiple time periods, that's a good sign the company's doing well. Now, a year ago, the shares were really, really high. The shares aren't traded very often. And so they went from $20 to close to $30 in really short time on absolutely no news. And so the fact they fell back kind of wasn't a super surprise. Now, again, did I expect it? No, or I would have sold at $30. So I'm not saying that we all should have known it, but it's kind of one of those things where I don't really look at the price 12 months ago and say, oh, it's been terrible because, or great because. It's just the 12-month number ago was a 12-month number. The shares were high. That's fine. They're down now. It is what it is. I think on balance, the shares are attractive at today's price, not because of where they were a year ago, just because I think based on the assets and the earnings, it's a pretty good price to pay for Soul Patts shares. I like the management a lot. They are the fourth generation of the same family to run the business. They have a value investing mentality. They're investing conservatively. They've paid dividends for, I want to say, close to 100 years. And the dividends increased, I want to say, for 20 years. It's a bottom drawer stock, right? It's not going to be a Tesla. It's not going to be an Apple. It's not going to be an Amazon. If you're buying it for that reason, you'd be very, very disappointed. It's a slow and steady wins the race kind of business. And as I said, it's outperformed over long time periods, as you've already mentioned, Gabriel, for very good reason. They just do the simple things really well on a year in, year out, decade in, decade out basis. So I like it. It's a buy for me. I own the shares. I bought some maybe a couple of months ago, Doc, maybe 3 months ago, I think. Don't hold me to that. It was some point kind of, you know, towards the end of last year. I haven't bought any recently. I still like the shares. I would happily have anyone buy them in their portfolio at the current price. Again, not because they're screaming bargains, not because they're going to double overnight, because I think they're a really, really great bottom draw stock. Doc, I've been pretty comprehensive and monologued for a little bit of time there. Anything else to add?
No. I think, again, any investment like Soul Patts basically is an investment in, it's a conglomerate, so you're investing in their ability to, you know, continue to invest wisely.
Yep,
and if
point.
You believe that, then I think, you know, it's a good investment. I think, again, yeah, the point about looking forward is important, right? Can they invest, can they continue investing looking forward? If they can, then they will do well.
Very good. Question from Zach. Hi, Scott. I was wondering if you could ask Doc. Oh, dear. Do I have to?
Ask the question. I hope it's a good one.
Zach, Zach, seriously, dude, you're killing me here. Funnily enough, this was all just interesting stat. This was sent at 11:05 p.m. on the 31st of December.
Okay.
Zach, I love the commitment, mate, to investing at less than an hour before midnight on New Year's Eve when you could have otherwise been out drinking, partying, having your time. You've decided to email us instead, which is either a wonderful comment or a sad comment in your social life, Zach. So I'm going to assume it's the former. Thank you for sparing us a thought at an hour to midnight on New Year's Eve. He says, "Hi Scott, I was wondering if you could ask Doc his opinion on Bubs. Bubs being the infant formula company, milk company. How does the recent sale of Bellamy's affect the thesis of Bubs? I know there is a demand for Australian infant formula from China, but does this change considering the facts? What sort of expectations does Doc have for a company like this? And you running a service differently to Doc, why are you not attracted to Bubs as an opposing point of view? Love the work you guys do. As a young fella, I really appreciate you fools. Happy New Year's." Thanks, Zach. It's very kind. That one came in on Twitter, I think. Doc, Bubs, do you like it? And how does the Bellamy sale affect your view?
Zach made good question. Okay, so Bubs, I do like it. Kevin Gandia and myself, we recommended this company in Extreme Opportunities. We like it for a couple of reasons. I think it's got a lot of growth happening in the goat milk side, funnily enough. And it has done a few different things. It's basically become more vertically integrated, which is slightly different from what Bellamy's was. Bellamy's was a brand play overall. It didn't own the milk. Actually, funnily enough, a lot of the Bellamy's milk came from South America. And people would think that it's Australian milk. It's actually South American milk that's been turned into...
That's not on the ads.
That's not on the ads, right? I'm just pointing out. So they've done a good job with the brand. Here, they're building building a brand around goat milk, in thesis being that goat milk is good for, you know, goat milk is actually closer to human milk that babies drink, and therefore it's good for, you know, good as an infant formula. There's a lot of demand in China. The thesis is relatively straightforward. There's a lot of demand in China. This can be, this is, you know, the margins are improving. This can be a high margin business, and, you know, it's growing off a small base. So, we're likely to see some exponential growth. They've done some beautiful partnering in China, which is really important to navigate the Chinese landscape. So they've got a fund with close ties to Alibaba, which has invested in it. They've got Being Made, which is a big company out in China, as a partner as well. They've got Chemist Warehouse as a backer. So they've done all those things, you know, strategically placing the brand. I actually personally own the stock as well. What I'll say is that this is definitely a very high risk, high reward type of stock. It's a small company, not yet profitable, growing fast, looking into the Chinese market, trying to break into the Chinese market and the other Asian markets. So, yeah, that's what I think about it. Does the Bellamy's takeover effect? Not really. I mean, Bellamy's was, overall, the infant formula segment should grow. You know, it's a competitive segment, but I think the whole fact that this is growing off a small base and it's got all these partnerships to essentially get self space and be able to sell via Tmall and things like that, for example, is what counts. So I think, I feel good about it. I'd just point out that it's likely to be risky. They probably do capital raises because it's not yet cash flow positive.
Interesting. So look, as an alternative, what's really fascinating, Doc and I agree on some stuff reasonably directly. Tesla is one. I'm happy not to own Tesla for different reasons. Doc is prepared to own it. Berkshire is another. We, again, have different expectations. There's also plenty of companies out there that we just simply don't own or buy in concert because we just have different focuses or different perspectives, or simply just in a universe of, 1,500 Australian stocks? We just haven't got stocks that are on the same page. Bellamy's was a recommendation of ours at Share Advisor before it was sold to the Chinese. We recommended a member sell it as that deal was going through. I look, stylistically for ShareAdvisor, and probably me as an investor, I'm not as much an early stage investor as Doc is. So I don't mind Bubs at all. I think they've got a really cool point of difference. I think they're a decent chance of doing very well. I'm just not kind of, I'm not as cutting edge as Doc when it comes to making those investment decisions. If you look at the scorecards of extreme opportunities that he runs or ShareAdvisor that I run, I have a deal for you on EO later, so stay tuned for that. Just very different stocks, very different approaches, very different perspectives. We have some companies in common, but not many. That's just the way we operate. And again, it's not because Doc doesn't like mine or I don't like his. We just kind of start with a different framework of investing. We say, this is how I invest. These are the companies that meet that framework. Warren Buffett has made a fortune over 55 years. One of our co-founders, David Gardner, is very much in the, I was going to say, the extreme opportunities mold. Maybe I should say it the other way around just to make sure he doesn't get unhappy with you, Doc. David Gardner is a high growth investor, very similar to Doc's style, right? Doc has been a fan of David's for a very long time. Both those guys have done extraordinarily well over long periods of time, doing something very, very, very different. I doubt there's any overlap at all. Both have done well. Equally, there are people who follow both those strategies have done badly because they've chosen stocks badly. So it's one way of just saying, look, just because we don't have the same view on the same company doesn't mean we're necessarily diametrically opposed. So Bubs, for me, was just simply, it's not a big enough or proven enough company yet for me to be interested. Not because I think it's terrible, just because I just haven't, as a filter, I tend not to buy those sorts of businesses.
I was just going to, maybe this is just horribly, casting things into into frameworks.
I like it. Not frameworks, good.
So Scott Phillips is and ShareAdvisor.
They're kind.
I'm very kind. They're like, mid-cap growth is sort of what I think of the style and the type of companies that, for example, ShareAdvisor looks at. ShareAdvisor does look at small companies occasionally, but, they would still look for it to be profitable and, sustainably profitable and things like that, even if it's a small company, right? And for that, they'd be happy to take it slightly lower growth if available, right? So I think it's mid-cap growth, really. It's not large cap. So it's like mostly mid-caps. And most of the successful companies are actually, mid-cap. And mid-cap, by definition, in the Australian sense, mid-cap is how I look at it. we at Extreme Opportunities are really more small cap growth, right?
That
basically moves down sort of in the market caps. And we are looking at $500 million or less typically. There are some companies that we have overlaps on, and most of the time what happens is the overlaps actually are, where I think there is a price opportunity or there's been a sell-off or, it's just a global opportunity and therefore, the growth runways are long and therefore it sort of fits that multi-bagger type of thing. So we're looking more for multi-baggers, they're not looking necessarily for large multi-baggers, but what the flip side is that we would probably have a lower strike rate. By strike rate, I mean the success relative to, say, the index or the benchmark that we are competing against. At Extreme Opportunities, we are basically trying to be right maybe four or five times. At ShareAdvisor, they're probably trying to be right, six times.
Yep.
And that little bit makes a difference in terms of what you do, how you invest, and so on. So it's not necessarily that, I could disagree, but it doesn't make, if I disagree with Scott, it doesn't mean that he's wrong, right? Mm. So I disagree with a lot of stuff and, I'm wrong a lot of times, but,
I think we own an Apple or Tesla and we all know how that's went.
The thing is that, it just depends on, I could be right fewer times, but I could still be okay. And he could be right more often and still be okay. And, we can still work out even. So, that's the long and short of it.
And super important, right? Don't try and invest along someone else's style. If you're listening to this and you're like, you know what? I feel like Doc Style is right for me. Then EO is right for you. And don't try and buy SA because you'll be disappointed by the lack of excitement or big outsized successes. Equally, if you're the sort of person who wants a bit more conservatism, a bit higher strike rate, EO will still do well for you if you follow it, but it'll be harder to follow for you as an investor because you simply won't be as comfortable with the volatility or the style. So pick the service that you think is right for you is always the best advice.
Yeah.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, a question from Adrian as we come towards the end of this particular special mailbag episode. We've got a little bit to go, but, we're getting towards it. So savour it while you're here, which Adrian does, because Adrian says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. Thanks for answering my question. I listen religiously while at work to maximise my productivity." I'm not entirely sure how to answer that, Adrian. I'm glad you're listening. I'm not sure when it's helping your productivity unless we're so boring that you'd rather work. I'm not sure how that works, but that's a question for you and your boss, and we're just happy you listened. Thank you. He says, "I wanted to get your views on Freelancer as it hasn't been a profitable pick for me so far after a few years." So I'm down 32%. "And the float on the stock is fairly low. There are huge fluctuations in the price, particularly on the downside." We know that feeling. "A director has topped up twice over the last month." And this was sent in December, so just kind of take your mind back about a month. "A director has topped up twice over the month of December, and I still believe in the CEO and the new direction it is going. But my emotions are getting a hold of me and wondering if I should keep buying more to dollar cost average. I understand you can't provide personal advice, so the question is more about your views on the company and how to know when you might be wrong when you can see the green shoots, but the market is saying no." That's a really, really, really great question, Adrian. You framed it perfectly. And so because it's a hard one, I'm going to get Doc to answer it.
I was going to say, I was just thinking, is this coming my way?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Adrian, mate, I'm going to disappoint you a little bit here by saying, I'll answer the second part. The first part, freelancers, a company I've looked at a few times, and, it's been on my, watch list or our watch list, but it has never quite made it as a cut of a recommendation. It's... For different reasons, but so I don't know the specifics right now to talk about that particular stock at the moment, right? But I have a general theory or thinking around the emotional part of the question, right? What do you do? So for number one thing I'll say is that it's hard, but you need to dissociate the share price from the company.
Yeah,
which is basically saying, that sounds pretty oxymoronish, right? So I think what you need to do is forget how the share price volatility, and you said it's a small float. So small float companies actually do have a lot of fluctuation in their share price, just by definition, because they're small float and less people are trading it. But if you believe that the company has a bright future and you have, and it's not just belief, right? You have to have something to back it up and something in the actions of the company or some sustainable, something that shows you or something in the plan or something about the market or, the market opportunity and the competitive space and things like that. So if you believe that and they can execute on that, and then you think that this company has a future, which is much, much brighter, then of course, if the share price falls, that's like a great thing, mm-hmm. right? However, the market is kind of not that dumb either, right? I mean, and I say this because otherwise what happens is you could have what I call the, you know, the catching the falling knife sort of problem, yeah. right? The market, if the market is punishing something, there is a reason behind it. Now, it can punish on the upside and the downside, right? It can punish a lot more or mm-hmm. it can punish less. You got to figure that out. But the market is good at figuring out at least the kind of the direction, right? If it's bad news, they're going to, you know, they're going to give it a solid hammering. If it's good news, they're going to give it a pop, right? And they often tend to, you know, what I think is the magnitude that can differ, but I think the direction typically tends to be right. If it was not that right, then, I mean, you know, again, I'm not saying the market is efficient, but that's true. So if the share price is falling, typically that means that something about the strategy is not working, right? Now, has the market overreacted? That's something to think about. Is the company sort of in a transition? Then I think the question really is, is it a transition or a turnaround? Now, here's the important thing, right? Most turnarounds don't turn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you believe it's going to turn? Right? All of those things I think you have to consider. So if you believe the future is bright, then lower share price and averaging down makes sense. If you think the future is uncertain,
yeah,
then it's a hold, or maybe even it could be a sell, right? Yeah. I mean, again, you have to consider those things while making your decisions. And the final thing I'll say is, it is useful to think in terms of how big a position is. Like if the position is making you think about it, and it's, you know, you are thinking too much about it, and it's like consuming you, that's probably too large, mm-hmm. right? That's another reason not to add to something, is like, well, it's consuming you, even if it's a good buy, right? And it's a psychological thing, because you want to be as an investor in control of your decisions, mm-hmm. right? Because that's, I think, how you actually get bad returns, by not being in control of your decision-making process.
I can't beat that, mate. I think that's right. You've got to separate the past share price performance from the current business and work out whether the business is worth less than it will be in the future, in which case you want to buy it. Don't ignore the market is my only other thought. As Doc said, the market kind of tends to get these things either right, or at least the bear case is worth knowing and understanding. So if you're looking to average down, I'd be saying, with why doesn't the market agree with you? What does the market disagree about? And see if you can find somewhere. Online's a great place to go, or just think through, why could the market be right and I could be wrong, and start from that point forward. I have no view on the company, unfortunately. I don't follow it particularly closely. I would be disinclined to add too much more to a smaller business that is not being rewarded by the market, and frankly, thus far, hasn't yet shown enough green shoots to really justify your faith. You may be better off waiting to see more results before you throw more money at something, particularly if it gets a larger and larger part of your portfolio. If it's your best idea, you can make an argument for it, but don't get sucked into throwing more money just because it's cheaper. The only thing you've got to do is turn a dollar into $2 over time. You don't have to make that dollar extra profit in the same company you've already lost some money on. And again, doesn't mean you can't, but across the entire universe of investment options, is that your single best idea for more money right now? If it is, maybe great. If it's not, then maybe think about putting the money somewhere else. How's that, mate?
That sounds brilliant.
I'm going to finish with a really, really cool email. And this is a longish one, so fair warning, but I want you to stick with me, because I like the way this email is communicated. Now, the correspondent has asked that we not use their name, so I won't. This is kind of one of those good news stories, Doc, and I quite liked it. So let me just run through the email. We've got some questions as we go. So we're kind of going to do it. The questions have been asked in the body of the email, so I'm going to tell the story and we'll answer the questions as we go. We'll try and keep it quick. He says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. If you decide to reply on the podcast, please don't use my name. We're not. First up, I'm a fan of yours." Well, thank you very much, so-and-so, Mr. So-and-so. "I listen to your pods and I'm working through your back catalogue." No, I'm not just saying that, Scott. That's a bit... Why do you think I would say that? Anyway, "most of your podcasts have been really enjoyable and entertaining, and if they stop being so, I expect a full refund. Well, I can promise we will pay you exactly back what you've paid for these podcasts if you don't like them. So feel free to send us the angry letters to somewhere other than us." He says, "I'm a member of Extreme Opportunities. Thanks, Doc. And I tried SA, but as I'm globally focused, I felt I had too many ideas to process, given I also subscribe to two Motley Fool US services, and decided for now not to subscribe to SA Australia." Sorry, Scott. Mate, that is more than fine. David Gardner said this week on his podcast, "If it's not working for you, don't join or don't stay." I can only echo that. So no dramas at all. If you're enjoying Doc and our US services, then I'm very, very happy that you're a happy fool. "I'm a middle-aged man. I feel your pain, Scott, and always have a laugh when you jokingly grumble about the questions from 20-somethings." They're not jokes. I'm genuinely grumbling.
I'm grumbling too.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you fools are my investing brothers. Well, that's kind of cool. I share a laugh with you, get some tips, hear your words of caution, wisdom, and optimism. Yes, Scott, even your words, not just Doc's. I'm starting to feel like I'm the butt of the jokes here. I'm not sure about that. You've done this investing thing a lot. I've not. So much of what I'm doing reinvesting the foolish way, capital F foolish, is based on me trusting you guys, which I do, having verified your results and listened to you guys putting yourselves out there all the time. Here's to transparency, to which we say hear, hear. I'm a total newbie. I only started investing very nervously in early 2018 and have some questions I'd appreciate you helping me out with. I now have 33 stocks and ETFs, or exchange-traded funds. He says ETFs make up approximately 55% of the value of my portfolio. Don't judge me, Doc. ETFs consist of large-cap, global-focused bonds and property. These positions reflect how I started investing 2 years ago, and now with the help of you fools, I've started buying only direct stocks. Thanks to you fools more successfully now than when I was on my own. So here's the thing. Many of those direct stock positions make up only 0.5% through to 5% of the value of my portfolio. I'm aware you offer general advice only. Thank you. That's all we can do. And nothing is specific to my situation. All right, Doc, question one. I have lots of small positions, and I'm not sure if I should add more new companies or look at building up the more successful positions. What do you say?
Okay, so this is an interesting question. You know, and again, a general comment, there's actually no one right answer for this, unfortunately, right? So in The Fool, we generally say, you know, we think that 15 to 30 companies sort of gets you a diversified portfolio, assuming that the 15 to 30 companies are diversified. You can't get diversification by buying, say, five banks and two grocers, right?
Right.
So that's the thought.
15 retailers is not diversified.
Yeah. I'll tell a little bit of a personal story here. When I sort of started, you know, my investing journey, I had a lot of positions, and over time, I've become a bit more concentrated, but I'm not that concentrated. I probably have, like, you know, 30-odd, you know, companies, 35-odd companies that I own, but at one point, I probably had 50-odd companies that that I had. So there's no right answer. I think you can do well with both.
Yep.
The thing with small positions is that if you're investing in, like, for example, with EO, I would say small positions are great, because if the stock works out, if it's a five-bagger, a small amount of money would do you well. If it goes down 80%, you'd be happy that you put in a small amount of money. This is actually not my line, but somebody else's line, a fool called Tom Engle. He says that all the time. And here's the other thing. The other thing that I'd point out is with you can start small. This is to answer that ad portion. Mm. If a company is executing, don't be afraid to add on the way up, right? This sounds psychologically, it's difficult because you anchor on the price that you paid in the past. But if the company is executing, is doing well, it's becoming, you know, it's becoming de-risked, the price, of course, is going to go up, right? Because the future value is probably also going up. And so therefore, on the way up, you can add. So you can build up positions over time. I almost always start small with my positions, especially in small companies, largely for that reason that, you know, I want to learn about the company. I want to understand the company. I want to take my time. And I want the thesis to see playing out. And if the thesis is playing out, and if it's got a wrong runway, then I don't worry about it.
Nice. I like that. I'm going to agree with all of that, mate. The only thing I would say is I think I would have no more than you can keep track of. Other than that, I don't think you need to worry about how big or small they are. What I would say, though, is always add money, generally speaking, to your best idea at any point in time. If that's a new company, great. If that's an existing company, great. You want to maximize the value of each new dollar you're adding to the investment allocation. Question two, should I sell down the ETFs where they overlap and repurpose that money elsewhere?
This is a great question. Again, this is a comfort thing, right? A lot of people build the core of their portfolio using ETFs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's nice and great because it provides instant diversification. Now, here's the thing, right? If you, if you own Apple and Microsoft, Apple, Microsoft, and, you know, Amazon and something else, right? Mm-hmm. Those are going to account for like 40% of many ETFs. So if you're going to buy them separately and they own the ETFs, it's like a bit of a duplication. So you want to make sure that you don't have too much of that duplication happening. A little bit of duplication is probably okay because it just means that the weight of the individual holdings go up. So that's the side about the overlap. I think, yes, if the ETFs are overlapping, then that makes sense to not have the overlap, because if they're overlapping, well, it's not really adding anything else, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of diversification, which is one of the key benefits of having ETFs.
Yep.
As, I guess, one becomes comfortable, I would say that, you know, you you want to own individual stocks if you believe that you want to beat the market, right? If you want to beat the market, then that's the way to do it. ETFs right. in general. I mean, even with ETFs, you can, depends what you call the market here. But let's assume that the major market index, you're following the ASX, say 300 or the ASX All Ordinaries, and then you want to do better than that. And you can do it by getting another ETF that is focused on something else, which could be a sector specific or another index, right? Mm. But in general, the individual stocks are going to help you beat the market. But if you want to do that, either you're following somebody's advice or you know. So I think as you become comfortable, that strategy makes sense. But I think, again, people should do whatever makes them really comfortable. Because I think that comfort thing is very important, because that's how you're going to be able to deal with volatility. And I can assure you, if one thing I can assure you is there's going to be a lot of volatility in the stock market. So you want to be comfortable in whatever you do.
Yep. I agree. I think that's spot on. I think overlapping ETFs make no sense unless you actually want the extra concentration. So if you've got overlapping, just know that's effectively what you're choosing. If this was one single ETF, would you want the weightings as they currently are? If the answer is yes, then keep them. If not, then you should absolutely sell them to get the weighting you're looking for. Question three, mate. Bond ETFs, are they a good or bad idea? Now, he also says, yes, despite what you say, I'm jittery about a correction and having to explain that to my wife. So he also then says, by the way, after that, of course, my horizon is until I die, as I get this as a long-term game. Bond ETFs with a wife who cares about corrections and volatility, what do you do?
Well, so I don't have any bonds, right? I know that in some portfolios, people like to have bonds because it provides that, you know, lower volatility, but the lower volatility comes with lower returns. And
right, so.
That's the unfortunate part. So, yeah. I mean, so it again... it really comes down to personal preference, right? I mean, if you really can tolerate the volatility, then I would take the volatility and take the higher return, right? But if you really need that mm-hmm. comfort, then, you know, it's like a bond is like getting a slightly better than term deposit type of return, right?
Yeah.
So if you need that, by all means, but you know, this is really like, again, it really depends on what one wants to do. Like, I don't do it, but again, I can understand why somebody does it. I know people who do it. I know people mm-hmm. who don't do it. So,
yeah, I see no reason for bond ETFs at all, with the exception of the reason you rightly point out, which is you have either yourself or a family member who is going to freak out if shares fall. If you need to mitigate the size of falls, then something like that is a good idea. Just be careful about which bonds they're investing in. But if it's a broad bond ETF, I think that's probably okay. Just know that it's going to cost you some return. Now, as I said before about lots of different things, sleep at night test. If you or your wife sleep better at night having some bonds in your portfolio, then by all means keep them. I don't have any, nor does Doc. I wouldn't. We just have to accept that volatility is the answer. A little bit of, without being condescending to your partner, a little bit of education. So something like the Vanguard index chart. If you Google Vanguard index chart 2019, you can see a 30-year chart of the market, including the dot-com crash, including the GFC. If you can show your wife that's a look, went from here to here. Just, you know, have as few bonds as your wife is comfortable with, and as many as you need to keep her comfortable is probably my answer. I don't mean that in any meaningful, condescending or critical way. Just literally, that's the reality. So I wouldn't have as many, more than you need, but you absolutely should have as many as you do need to make your life worth just comfortable for both you and your wife. He says, my wife and I have savings, and the share portfolio represents about 23% of our liquid assets. I have super and also salary sacrifice into it. My wife has nearly none. I earn less than the average wage. I'd like us to put more into our shares, up to 30%, but my wife prefers closer to 10 or 15. Should we go to 30% or more or less in shares of liquid assets?
Oh boy. You just like putting these. So
again, I'm asking the questions here. I'm asking the questions.
Again, it's a great question. Again, I think this really depends, right? I mean, so almost all of our investments, with the exception of the house, are effectively in the stock market, putting aside, what would I say, like, you know, rainy day funds. Basically, we have funds that can survive us for some time, which we think is plenty. And beside that, everything's basically invested. That's how I roll. Does that work for somebody else? I don't really know. Effectively, as I said, it goes back to the same thing. Effectively, if you are tolerant, if somebody is tolerant of volatility, then I think investing it makes sense. I'm happy to tolerate the volatility. Mm. If somebody is not, then I think they would need to keep more just for their comfort. But yeah, I mean, looking out, I feel that, you know, putting the money in asset that is going to deliver the most return relative to the risk makes sense to me. That would be my answer.
Makes sense to me. I can't do any better than that other than, again, I think shares are going to probably be the best performing asset over the next 50 years, given your time horizon is until you die. I see no reason to limit or artificially reduce the amount of liquidity or the shares you're having within your account. But if you're going to do that, as I said, just again, bear in mind, every decision you make on that has a potential return issue or risk or downside, which is cool. And again, it may be the best thing for you guys as a couple and as a family. Just be mindful of that is an implication, right? So the less you've got in shares, generally speaking, no guarantees because we don't know what the future holds. But in the past, the less you had in shares, the lower your returns have been. So think about how you do that. He says, we have no other debts. Our tiny unit is nearly paid off. Well done. It was hard to get to this financial point, but worth it. Now, this is kind of a cool part of the story, mate. He says, I'm a migrant. My high school graduating gift was not a sports car, but I inherited $2,000 debt in dental costs and then needed to buy a vehicle to get to work. That's a lot of debt for an 18-year-old with no savings. My folks had no extra money, hence no mum and dad bank. Mum was a saver, although we had very little. Dad, who never finished high school, earned and spent as much as mum would let him. Neither had an idea about investing. None. Zero. Zilch. Dad got dudded with his super, as his money was with a commercial provider that bled his account dry. Bastards. Mum's government account, by comparison, kept accruing. Neither parent could speak English before leaving our home country. Buying a house was their dream for the new country, and they set about doing that and achieved it. That is very, very cool. I'm kind of getting goosebumps reading this, actually, Doc, which is kind of fun. They succeeded in ways not possible in their homeland, and they remain forever grateful for the opportunities offered in Australia. A good reminder for us when we whinge about how good or bad things are in this country. I graduated from university, then with a modest HECS debt, huge for me at the time, and again the need to buy another vehicle to get to work. I lived at home during uni so I could walk to campus, and my parents supported me. My wife and I have paid off our small apartment and saved every penny we want to invest, but it's frightening as I've not had anyone to teach me what to do. I find many finance people a bit off-putting, not you fools though. They seem to be in a bubble and disconnected from what life is like for the majority of people, i.e. no savings, large debts, and living paycheck to paycheck. I'm astounded that I can earn money from buying and holding stocks than going to work for the day. I find that concerning as the people I grew up with work so hard for their small incomes, and now by doing very little, we who have spare cash can get money for doing very little. My wife doesn't really want to discuss investing as she's aware of the exploitative nature of capitalism and is very sensitive about it. But I want us to be financially secure as we age. My wage alone and interest on savings won't help much towards our retirement income. I don't ever want to return to living hand to mouth. What I like about you fools is your optimism, desire to help, and thoughtful responses to questions. Here's the challenge, mate. Given that, I'm surprised you fools continue to promote Apple and Amazon, to name but two companies who are arguably not very ethical. They are terrible corporate citizens who pay a pittance in taxes, which I would argue transfers wealth from the many to the few. I actually think companies should pay no tax and the taxes should be paid on all income or expenditure and assets, but that's for another day. Here's question five. How do you rationalize promoting companies that exploit workers, pay them so little, offer harsh working conditions and exploit communities, and in brackets, seek huge concessions to set up in a town and then disappear when the agreements end, and pay effective tax rates of less than a few percent? And kind of question six is the same. How can that be good for individuals, communities, and the environment? Let's start with question five. How do you rationalize Apple, mate, or Amazon when they pay little tax, exploit their workers, and demand huge concessions to do business?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. Okay. So first of all, I think I'll not put Apple and Amazon in the same bucket. I own both of those shares, and I read enough about what they do. It is true that... So the working condition for an average Amazon employee is actually significantly harder than the working condition for an average Apple employee, yes. And I think what she's putting, what our listener is putting here is the average contractor that Apple is using for building stuff. But that's, you know, that's a different thing. It's not really Apple employees that they're contracted out to somebody else. Now, this might appear counterintuitive, but here's the thing. what I think we need to realize, and I'm saying this as exactly as a migrant to this country, beautiful country, and having seen, for example, what happens in India or in the subcontinent, it is important to realize that when a foreign company goes and sets up shop, and even if they're paying pittance, which is pittance relative to what we would pay here, that pittance is actually a lot of money there. And that does lift up the standard of living, right? And the very fact that there have been so many manufacturing things set up in China is what has actually lifted China up to what it is today. So therefore, it's a little bit of how, you know, wealth transfer in some sense happens. That's what capitalism is. They can do something at a lower cost compared to us. And therefore, we want them to do that. And if they do that, it lifts up their standard. Now, today, you know, China is talking about competing on AI, right? That's how we lift the game. So I'm not really against that in that sense. I think the companies also do a lot of good things, like, for example, support sustainability projects. Mm. You know, Apple, for example, is committed to using 100% renewable energy for all its all its usage. They've been doing that for some time. I know Microsoft has committed to going carbon negative. So, I mean, companies they take stances on things that are useful and relevant for citizens. For example, Apple has a stand on privacy. Microsoft has other stands that they take. So I think it's not all dark. Yes, they do, you know, the taxation thing. So there is tax avoidance in terms of the fact that, you know, they might not be paying local taxes or appropriately because they do transfer. They pay, you know, basically pay for royalty of the IP, and that results in transfer here and there. That's an international issue. That's not necessarily specific to Apple, Amazon, or any particular company. It is more of an international issue as the world becomes more global. How do you deal with taxation, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what I think everybody's right now, grappling with, is how do you tax people on this? You know, there could be many solutions for that. You know, we could probably not tax anyone, just tax people for the services that they consume. That's the solution, right? You have a service tax and not have tax for anything else, right? And that addresses it. And I think to a large extent, service taxes, for example, you know, address the taxation issue, right? If you're consuming a service, you pay tax for that. Mm-hmm. So I think I look at the positive side. A lot of innovation happens because of businesses. Businesses create jobs, right? You know, the Apple created the computer, created the iPhone, created the App Store. The App Store resulted in, you know, all these other businesses being created. The whole sharing economy runs on basically the fact that there was an App Store and somebody created the opportunity. So I think we forget what we get. I think that, you know, and we should not lose sight of that. And I think capitalism in a way it takes the world forward. Yes, is capitalism the best solution? Is it perfect? No. It's probably the better solution of the lot, is my view.
Yeah, I'm going to try and tackle this one only because I feel like I have a couple of things to say and then we'll wrap this episode up. So here's the thing. I agree with almost everything Doc said. I think Winston Churchill said democracy was the worst system of government except for every other system that had been tried. I've in the past already lifted that phrase and talked about democratic capitalism because I think both together are particularly important, particularly in the Western world. And I think, to me, for all of its flaws, it is still better than everything else that's been tried, including, you know, different versions of socialism and communism. There are some wonderful systems that work well in theory. I would love, frankly, to think that a world where everyone had everything they needed and as much of everything they needed and everything was wonderful, I think that would be the utopia that we would all choose. The problem is it doesn't actually work. And so there's kind of that reality of like, okay, here's what I'd like to be true. Given it's not, here's the next best idea. And that's kind of a bit crappy. Like if you're someone who believes, it sounds like your wife does, it sounds like you do as well. Questioner, I won't use your name. Given all that, I get how you would desperately want that to be true, as would I. It's just not. And so you kind of got to live in the real world a little bit. Now, that doesn't for a second excuse anything that's done to exploit workers or treat people badly. I think there should absolutely be higher wages paid internationally. There should be better working conditions internationally. And I think we should support, frankly, if you're that way inclined, human rights groups to actually improve those things. And yes, put some pressure on companies to improve those as well. Doc is dead right. It has absolutely been fundamental to improving living standards in China for China to become the world's factory. Now, there's people working 12-hour days, 6-day weeks. I think that's really, really terrible. And I would choose to have that change. I would like to think the Apples and the Microsofts and the everyone else's, this is not Apple bag, would absolutely be trying to enforce a version of Western standards on those companies. Now, at some level, if Apple does do that and says, look, I want to pay everyone double and have them work half as much, and their competitors don't, Apple's products become all of a sudden completely cost prohibitive. If an iPhone all of a sudden costs $2,000 and an appropriate Samsung alternative was $400 because they work people 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, then at some point Apple's efforts come to nothing because no one buys any more Apple phones, the company goes out of business, and more exploitative companies carry on. So it's one of those really messy realities. Again, in a perfect world, would it be the case? No. But given we are in this world, in this life, you kind of got to – it's kind of the imperfect pragmatic solutions we need to be looking for. So I would love to think these guys can be part of a solution. I'd like to think they could work harder at it. I absolutely include Apple in that. I include Amazon in that, by the way, in terms of in the US where they have some unhappy workers. Maybe they're pushing their workers a little bit too hard. I don't think it costs anything to be a little bit kinder, a little bit more reasonable. It's not that hard, particularly when you have that sort of market power to do some of that stuff. So I think that's what I'd say first. Second thing, tax-wise, I completely agree with you. I think these companies are paying so little in tax, I would absolutely change the tax laws in Australia and around the world. I would also, though, make sure those tax laws were properly, followed through on. We know there are companies like miners that have so-called marketing hubs in Singapore because they pay less tax there. It's a paper transaction that lets them pay less tax in Australia. And you're right, you and I pay more tax or get less services because they do that, and that is absolutely inappropriate. So I would absolutely change that. Again, though, back in the real world, to Doc's point, if a company can simply move their operations, some can't, by the way, you can't get your iron ore anywhere else. So I think the miners should absolutely be a first target of any government looking to maximize their revenue and not, again, to punish anyone, just to actually tax them what they're supposed to be paying. But I would absolutely be going to those companies saying, hey, guys, enough's enough, time to pay up. Also, some of the online companies, there may be, frankly, at some level, and you kind of allude to this, a need for, and we're getting into public policy here at some level, but a need for a broader or higher GST. To make sure that if you're a company selling, and I'll use Netflix here, if you're a company selling subscriptions in Australia, you pretend the sale is made in America or the Cayman Islands, you say all your costs are over there too, and so you can sell millions and billions of dollars worth of services here, pretend there's no tax, no profit made here because all the costs are allegedly overseas, and as a society, we've got to say, well, hang on, are we comfortable to spend many, many tens, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Australian consumer dollars here and get no tax benefit, no societal benefit from that? I think it's reasonable to say that we should be capturing more of that revenue in some way, shape, or form in Australia. Otherwise, we're leaking tax revenue from the Blockbuster here or the Greater Union cinema chain up to an overseas player who takes all the money and pays not enough tax. So there are ways that government should respond to that. I don't know, frankly, that any company should be obliged to pay more tax than they otherwise have to, right? That's the way the tax laws are written. If you write a tax law that says company A can pay tax or get these tax deductions, and they're entitled to claim those. I have no problem with companies paying as little tax as they're legally required to, because that's the way the laws are written. If the laws are wrong, it's up to our governments to fix them, not companies say voluntarily say, oh, right, okay, fine. I'm not paying as much tax as I'm paying as much as I have to, but I probably should pay more, so here's a donation. I just don't think that's reasonable or likely, not because I'm a capitalist, not because I want my companies to pay less tax, just because that's kind of the way this works, right? No shareholder should want their company to pay more tax than they have to. It's the government's job to say, hey guys, time to fess up and pay up a bit more in cash. So I don't like that Amazon pushed their workers too hard in the US. I don't like that Apple and their compatriots pushed their Chinese workers too hard, pay them not enough, give them crappy conditions. I would like that to improve, but I'm pragmatic about how that happens. And I'm not entirely convinced that as investors, a bit like the ethical investing problem, if I don't invest in Apple and Amazon, and I invest in some other company, Apple's behavior doesn't change, right? As a consumer, I can change that. As an investor, back to that ethical investing thing, it just makes literally zero difference. As much as we wanted to, as much as we might get upset, angry, aggravated about it, it just doesn't matter. And that's kind of, again, maybe it sucks, maybe it doesn't, but that's just the reality of the world we're living in. He finishes off, Doc, by saying, I know this is personal. Feel free to skip the question. We didn't. As I understand, we all need to invest in companies that help us sleep well at night. I hope you get a sense that I do deeply appreciate what you two and the rest of the foolish people do for us non-finance people. Cheers and fool on. I don't know about you, Doc, but I reckon that's a pretty good way to finish the podcast.
I think that's a brilliant way to finish the podcast.
With one exception, because it's a good deal on your service, Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. And you can get access to that by going to fool.com.au/E. O for Extreme Opportunities, EO Podcast. One of the special deals we've got from our bosses at The Motley Fool, who set these prices and make these deals, but I reckon it's a pretty good one. And if you like what Doc has to say, don't do it just because he's here, but you can if you want. Do it because he's going to help you get great investment returns, a good investment education, and again, do what you want with that money. Compound it, give it away, give it to the kids, spend it on a really, really expensive overseas holiday if you want. But if you want to invest well, there are very few better ways to do it, in my view, than joining Motley Fool Opportunities by going to fool.com.au/EO podcast. And that does wrap us up. But before we go, make sure you subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app, as I want to say from time to time. And, excuse me. And I'm sure if you like what we're doing, you can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app, as I like to say. Just throw some stars, give us a review, toss a pair, tell your friends. Just turn to the person next to you right now on the train, in the bus, at the beach, in the office. Say, hey, particularly Adrian before, who's listening while he's at work. Just turn to someone beside you, no matter if you know them or not. So just tap on the shoulder, say, hi, I'm, whatever your name is, Fred. I think you really would appreciate the Motley Fool Money podcast on Triple M. Look it up. Go on, do it. I know you want to. Of course, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/Triple M. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of Foolish Insight. Have the rest of a good rest of your weekend and fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.